dipoles are connected in the center, and they're hung like plumb lines from the very top of the pipe on opposite sides. The pipe is only a 3/4 inch pipe, so he has 3/4 of separation, roughly, maybe an inch.
Whoa. The words I heard in the beginning were very different than that. You gotta realize here, John, you're looking at this beautiful photograph or diagram the guy has mailed to you, and then by words, you gotta make believe I'm a blind man and you gotta describe to me what this thing looks like. Okay, that's very different. 10-foot pipe, doesn't matter what the diameter of the pipe is, 3/4 inch, we'll say. 10 to 3/4 inch, 1 inch, doesn't matter. Hanging vertically, parallel to the pipe, is a 70 centimeter dipole on one side and a 2 meter dipole on the other side. Therefore, they've got the two dipoles have a separation of, let's call it 3/4 inch, 1 inch, 1.5 inch, way, way inside of the wavelength of either one. Very different situation. Okay. When it comes to mounting various kinds of antennas, stacking distances close to each other, this is by far the most extreme example I've ever heard of. Okay. I'm going to predict that the 2 meter dipole worked like a charm. The 440, the 70 centimeter dipole, because the ends of it are seeing the capacitance of the nearby 2 meter structure, only an inch or so away, separated by PVC, and the PVC separation is actually hurting, not helping, because the PVC is a higher dielectric material spaced in between the two, increasing the capacitive coupling between the two. Therefore, the amount of retuning required of the 2 meter dipole is going to be significant. Our prediction, the 440, 7070. If the 70 centimeter dipole, by its original design, I'm picking numbers out of the air now, 70 centimeters, 432 is my favorite frequency in free space, the wavelength of 27 inches. When you're building the half-wave dipole in the center of a Yagi on 432, the dipole is a little bit more than 12 inches long. Let me drop. So in quasi-free air, a 432 megahertz dipole is in the vicinity of 12 and a fraction inches long. But when I slap it against PVC pipe, which on the far side of the PVC pipe is a 2 meter dipole, I am guessing that if you insist on that closer spacing and you're not willing to add a little bit of a mechanical structure to give the 70 centimeter dipole a little bit greater spacing away from the pipe, that's the simplest thing. But if you're unwilling to do that for whatever reason, you're making a compact structure and you want it to be very low in visibility and you're going to paint it the sky gray so that it can't be seen from the ground and so on, in that case, you're going to have to significantly shorten the 70 centimeter dipole to bring it back into resonance. Because of the close spacing, because of the capacitive end loading, it's going to see the 12 inches of length probably is going to end up as 10 inches of length. And by the way, by way of you sweeping on, just feeding the 70 centimeter transmission line all by itself, sweeping it in frequency and looking at the standing wave ratio versus frequency, and you plot that so-called bathtub-shaped curve. Let me drop. In other words, on the vertical axis of your rectangular chart is going to be magnitude of standing wave ratio. The horizontal axis is going to be frequency. And maybe you're going to measure it every quarter megacycle, half megacycle, 1 megacycle, something like that. You plot that curve. You will rapidly find out if your 70 centimeter dipole is tuned high or tuned low. And I'm guessing that to get it to tune correctly, even before you hook it up to the diplex, it's just feeding that one all by itself. And what you do with the other transmission line almost doesn't matter. Feeding that one all by itself, I think you're going to have to shorten it to something like 10 inches to bring it back into resonance because of that amount of capacitive end loading. Does that make some sense, John? An unusual requirement, but I know this is a solvable problem if it must be mechanically that way. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Well, Dick, you're absolutely right because the 2 meter is working perfectly. He has no problem with it, tuning it. Whether he has the 70 centimeter on or not, it makes no difference, he said, in the tuning. But the 70 centimeter is a disaster. He hasn't tried shortening it. But also now, when he brings that down to 10 inches, maybe 9.5 inches, that's also going to affect the Q, is it not? Is it going to raise the Q?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that one, John. Whenever you do anything to a full free space half-wave dipole, that means that you've mechanically shortened it by a zillion different techniques. Putting a loading coil at the bottom, helical winding, top-hat capacitors at the top, zigzagging it, dipping down the ends and so on. Whenever you do any of the things that mechanically shorten a half-wave dipole, the Q will at first slowly increase. Later on, as you go further and further with those techniques, the amount of Q increases more rapidly. So the antenna will become a little bit more narrowband because of these higher Q techniques. End loading capacitance and close spacing to the 2 meter dipole. And by the way, remember I said so often that the lower frequency antenna, when you're stacking antennas real close, with rare exception, never even sees the higher frequency antenna that could be inches away. Opposite of common sense. Your eye says, boy, they're close. They're going to kill each other. The lower frequency antenna says, I don't see nothing. I'm in free space. That other thing is not there. That's the magic of resonance. Just like the LIPA or Con Ed power line that's in front of your house directly at the same altitude as your dipole, at the exact same altitude, and it's 50 feet away in the direction of your favorite signal you want to send to London, and you think it's going to kill you, you think it's going to create shadow. If it's non-resonant, it's not there. It casts a couple of square inches of shadow on your antenna, and your antenna has got 1,000 square feet of area to it. It ain't there. So the fact that he got such beautiful performance out of the 2-meter Yagi proves that. The fact that the 440 Yagi, 70-centimeter Yagi, is so troubled, he's going to have to retune it. He's going to have to make it significantly shorter. And it's now that you accept the fact that it's going to get shorter, let me drop it. Finding how much shorter. There are ways you could do computer modeling to find the exact answer, or very close to the exact answer. Or you can just go and do it. As long as you've got a standing wave ratio meter, and just to keep things simpler, don't even use the diplexer when you're making the measurements on the 70-centimeter antenna. Feed that transmission line directly with your bird watt meter or whatever it is that allows you to measure VISWA, and then trace out that curve, the bathtub curve of VISWA versus frequency, and you'll very rapidly find out exactly how much to shorten it. Once you re-resonate the 440 and the 70-centimeter antenna, it's going to work like a charm, and if its Q used to be 10, now the Q is going to be 12. It's not going to be a nightmare. It's not going to be huge different. So don't lose a whole lot of sleep over that. But this can be made to work. And as he makes it work, please ask him to come back and tell us what he had to do and how well it is working. KC2WGB, great question. K2RAW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. One other thing I thought of, I'd like to get your opinion. He has 10 feet of length of this PVC pipe. The 70 centimeter occupies such a small amount of area. Maybe he should leave that at the top and maybe lower the 2 meter a little bit. Do you think that would help?
Is that going to make it work a whole lot better? Not necessarily. Is that going to make the tuning procedure a hell of a lot easier? Absolutely. So as he separates them along the length of the pipe, yes, now the interaction effect, the capacitive loading that I'm talking about, will drastically decrease. If the 70-centimeter antenna saw as nearby capacitively loading nothing but a piece of PVC pipe, the amount of detuning required, retuning required, will be very small. But as you put it alongside of another metal 2-meter dipole, the amount of retuning is going to be significant, as you can tell. I'm guessing 10 and a half inches. We'll soon find out, so to speak. Now, he's got the 10 feet of pipe there because maybe he's trying to clear a local obstacle. He knows that on VHF frequencies, there's three things to make an antenna work well, other than resonating it. I really should list that first. But after the antenna is resonant and really working, the thing that makes a VHF antenna work well is altitude. So he wants to use every bit of that 10 foot of pipe. And if he had the resources to make it 20 feet of pipe and still mechanically be able to support it and or guy it, he'll get even more performance. So he's now got to weigh the compromise of altitude of antenna versus ease of tuning versus the obstacle he wants to clear and the amount of VHF performance he wants. Let me drop one other thing I want to tell you guys.
N2ACG with a comment.
Dave recognized. Pick you up in a second, Dave. The guys out at Symbol Technology, now known as Motorola Solutions Division of Symbol, out in Exit 62 in Holtsville, Long Island. Their 2-meter and 440 repeater antenna is in the middle of this great big metallic roof of that building. And when you stand on that roof and you look out over the edge, you're looking down, and you're looking on the expressway, you've got a beautiful line-of-sight view of the expressway to the east and to the west. That's the good news. But because that antenna is in the middle of this great big structure, and even though the antenna itself is 10 feet above the structure, because the structure goes for, oh, let me pick a number, 400 feet, it's a 400-foot square roof, roughly, and the antenna is roughly in the middle of the roof. The reflection off that roof and the edge protective railing and whatever on that roof, something about that combination is changing the antenna pattern. It's a beautiful antenna. Multiple antennas have been tried there. And the antenna pattern changes in such a way that I think its pancake pattern is being tilted up or tilted down, and therefore the repeater itself, you can measure the sensitivity, you can measure its VSWR, you can measure the power output from the duplexer. Everything should be great, and you should be able to talk 10 exits on the expressway. And you can talk 3 or 4 exits, and things start fading out real fast. The presence of that roof is creating a terrible impact on that particular antenna. If they had the permission to put a 50-foot tower on that roof, I guarantee you the world would get a hell of a lot better. It's going to take an act of Congress from Motorola to get permission to do that. But if they had the permission to do that, great things would happen. Dave, what's your experience in these areas? N2APG, K2LAW in the TechNet.
This is N2APG, and good evening to everybody. Dick, John. Just a quick suggestion. Why doesn't he, instead of having two separate dipoles, with two separate feed lines and a diplexer, why doesn't he make a dual-band ground plane type antenna? Using a simple SO239 on top, he can make a dual-band ground plane with very little difficulty, nice and lightweight, sits on top of the 10-foot PVC pipe, one feed line, no diplexer.
Good sounding suggestion. I know there's a commercial product that he could buy that does that. When it comes to home brewing that, Dave, and it sounds like you have done it, where would you send this writer, where would you send him to get the design for the dual band ground plane like antenna? Over to you, Dave, into APG, K2LAW.
There are a number of designs that I've seen online. The simplest one that I remember is a simple SO239. The four ground plane radials are about 18 inches long for VHF, and the vertical radiator, instead of having a single vertical radiator, you simply make two vertical radiators, and you put them in the shape of a V. So one side of the V would be VHF, about 18 inches long. The other side of the V would be UHF, maybe 6 inches long. And that goes into the top of the SO239.
That's a nice, simple-sounding design, Dave. Is that a Kosovar original? We're talking to Dave Kosovar. Is that a Kosovar original? Or do you remember where you saw the article and how to do that one, Dave? Into APG, G2LAW.
No, I take no credit for it. I did see it online, and just doing a search on dual band SO239 ground plane would probably come up. I'm not sure if it was on an ARRL website or some other website. But, you know, again, I have built the SO239 ground plane using the PVC pipe, and it's a real nice setup because it sits right into the hole of the PVC pipe. And the feed line, the coax, goes right down the pipe. So that's a real, you know, very easy setup to make. And again, no big deal. making it a dual band antenna, just put two vertical radiators on top instead of one.
Awful good suggestion, Dave. Glad you signed in. And this is one of those situations, by the way, where I often talk about building a half-wave dipole NZ. And when it comes to HF frequencies, and you're feeding it from the ground, as long as you've got a tall enough structure to support a full half-wave vertical dipole, works like a charm. A quarter-wave ground plane-like antenna mounted in your backyard, if you want high performance, requires a zillion ground plane radios. You're trying to make your backyard look like a great big sheet of copper, is what you're trying to do. If you had the ability to take that ground plane in the backyard and raise it a good number of wavelengths above ground, those zillion ground plane radios, come down to a requirement of about three radios tilted down at a slight angle, do the job beautifully. The only reason you're putting the radios in that case is to act as a quarter-wave open-circuited RF choke. The end of each radio is electronically a quarter-wavelength long, open-circuited. Therefore, at the end near the transmission line, it looks like a short circuit, and that stops the RF energy from blowing down the end of the coax cable. Because the whole structure is multiple wavelengths above ground, the RF energy that can look in between the radials doesn't see that volumetric lossy material called earth. When you mount it in the backyard, you got to put it down a zillion ground plane radials so that you're not lighting up the dirt and warming up the worms, if you know what I mean. But if the antenna is multiple wavelengths above the ground, like our VHF station masters and what else other else is, you don't need a zillion ground plane radials anymore. A few of them does the job beautifully. It does the choking action. There's no nearby dirt as a lossy material. And so in that particular case, quarter wave radiators work like a charm. Doesn't have to be half wave. So the quarter wave radiator that's 18 inches for 2 meters and roughly 6 inches or so for 470 should work like a charm with a slight V between the two. And the exact separation between the two, again, is the capacitive end loading effect. The 2 meter one will not see the 440 one. The 440 one, how close it is, let me drop. How close the tip of it is to the 2-meter one determines how much end-loading capacitance it's going to see and how much you should shorten it to bring it into resonance. And again, sweeping with your standing wave ratio meter, plotting visual versus frequency, will tell you if the bathtub curve, the bottom of it, is where you want it to be. And you've got another advantage here. Because of that 3-to-1 relationship in frequency, there's even a slim chance with a little bit of a loading coil in just the right place, only one radiator is required, using it on fundamental and third harmonic. But I would rather see the V-shape that Dave has. Okay, that's a nice way to go. Now the whole structure is at the top of the 10 foot of the PVC pipe, and with one piece of cable, without a diplexing filter, he's going to get darn good performance on both bands and maximum altitude within the physical constraints he's given us. That's another solution certainly worth considering. Have him tell us what he does when he does this on John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment.
It sounds like Ed wants to make a comment. Go ahead, Ed.
Say, Ed, how about a dual band J-pole? You don't need any radials and you don't even need a diplexer, over.
Another very good suggestion, Ed. Now, Ed, do you know of a particular place where we could tell the guy to go, which will show him the design of a dual-band J-pole? And even if you don't know of one, I'm pretty sure the answer is going to be, if I Google the word dual-band VHF J-pole, I think Google is going to find me a bunch of answers. But is there a favorite place where you would go for that design, Ed? K2GJE, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I bring it up because I have one that I bought from Arrow Antenna, over.
Okay, so it's a commercial product by Arrow Antenna. Roughly how many dollars was it? How long ago did you buy it, Ed? Back to you, Ed. Wait for the four beeps, sir.
I had this pole maybe 2 years ago. I don't remember price. It was definitely under $100, and it was all aluminum and very well made. I think they even have a diagram on their .com site, over.
Okay, so I'm going to repeat what Ed said. He bought it around 2 years ago. It was under $100, and he bought it from Arrow. It's an Arrow brand name antenna, dual band J-pole for 440 and 2 meters. Another good suggestion. Now back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, gentlemen. Thank you for the recommendations. Dick, I have no idea. He states here that he knows he could use quarter wave verticals, and he could get a combination, a dual band. For some reason, he wants two half waves, whatever he's doing. But I don't understand the PVC pipe 10 feet long. In the wind, that thing has got to be whipping around like crazy. So evidently he's trying to do something special here. Maybe I can find out. But good recommendations, and I'm sure he's listening. He said he would be. And maybe he can find something else that might work out a little better for him. What Dave said sounds good, and it's very simple. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I've got a slight suggestion here. And that is, if the 10-foot of PVC pipe is going to whip in the wind, and yes it is, it wouldn't be very difficult to dielectrically guy it. 130-pound Dacron fishing string, for instance, which is what I used on the 12-foot stressed parabolic dish antenna. August 1972, QST magazine. 130-pound test Dacron fishing string. And you could even paint it some dull color so it doesn't even show. That guying the pipe would stop the pipe from swaying. And there's lots of other dielectric materials you could use. And in some cases, you could even use metallic materials as long as it's not resonant. So guying the pipe to stop it from swinging or to build trunnion trusses on it. In other words, if you've ever seen these outriggers they've got on tuna fishing boats, where they've got these rods that go very far up into the air, out at a 45-degree angle on the starboard side and the port side of the boat, and they've got these spreaders on them with wires over the spreaders to give stiffening to those poles. There are various ways you can stiffen the pole. In fact, I even stiffened the center pole on that 12-foot stressed parabolic dish in that manner. So there's various ways you can stiffen the pole and stop it from swaying if that's what you want to do for the rest of the mechanical construction. One more comment, APG? Go ahead, Dave.
Just a comment regarding the PVC pipe. There's all sorts of PVC pipe. He doesn't want to use the white stuff. The white, cheapy stuff, that's not the pipe he wants to use when he's going to use it for a mast. He wants to use the gray stuff. I think it's called Schedule 40 or Schedule 80. The gray stuff is much stronger. It's UV resistant. It doesn't swing around a lot. It'll work great.
When it comes to selecting pipe, the gray stuff, which is UV protected, as opposed to the white stuff that's going to crumble in the UV exposure in a couple of years, is one thing to consider. Second of all, as you make the pipe, the exact same amount of PVC material, if you use larger and larger diameter of pipe with thinner and thinner wool, if you must make it light, as you increase the diameter of pipe, the cantilever stiffness goes up by a cube law. You double the diameter of a piece of pipe and keep the wall thickness the same. The piece of pipe is 8 times more stiff. So if it's the sway of the pipe, you want to stop. Make it larger in diameter, guying it, using trunnion trusses on it. There's various techniques you can stop it from swaying in the wind. But the gray pipe is certainly a good one. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Well, at least we gave him some options. Good idea. The trunnions are fine because they do use those on the outriggers, and they work very well. And they're also flexible. So, okay. Let me let it drop, and we'll go on to the next one.
Yeah, stand by a second. On the input, I heard somebody say RZ. Maybe that was QGZ. You didn't come to the machine, but I heard you on the input. Give me your call letters again, sir. Okay, John who does not come through the machine. Maybe he doesn't have the right 136.5 TO turned on. That was Kilo 2 India Zulu. And John said, when it comes to this kind of a structure, take a look at November 9 Tango Alpha X-ray.com. November 9 Tango Alpha X-ray.com, and you'll find further information. Did I get that correct, John? Kilo 2 India Zulu, K2LIW. Okay, John, thank you for that information. And let's hope you manage to find out how to turn on the 136.5 TL on your particular rig so you can come through the machine. I was hearing him beautifully on the input, but he wasn't coming through the machine. Okay, John, KC2WGB, you got it again. K2RIW and SICNAT.
WS2N.
Paul with a suggestion. Go ahead, Paul.
That guy would still want to use a PVC pipe. They have the C-PVC pipe, the Bornese PVC. That's good for outdoors.
Okay, is that the gray stuff, Paul? The chlorinated, the C-type PVC chlorinated? Is that the gray stuff that Dave was telling us about? Paul, you got it?
Now, he's talking about stuff the electricians use, you know, almost like, you know, EMT type of pipe. You know, they use it for conduit. Now, this is a actual pipe. I mean, you'll see it on the building where it's going to be exposed to sunlight. You know, the UV rays won't kill it. Thank you.
Okay, so the chlorinated, I think you're saying the main advantage of the chlorinated is it's known to be outdoor building applicable, known to be UV protected. Is that its main advantage, or is there also some extra stiffness to it? Back to you, Paul.
The dick isn't at the thin wall.
Okay, Paul's going to answer that. Go ahead, Paul.
40, John.
Give that to us again. She said schedule 40, so the fact that it's called schedule 40 implies that it's made for nice high hydraulic pressure on the inside, pretty thick wall thickness. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
I said, you know, you can get it schedule 40. I guess you could probably get 20 if you want, but the only one that I have is sold schedule 40. But you'll see if it drains and, you know, any outdoor work, you know, if they're going to run up the length of a building, you know, if they want something that's, that you don't worry about UV rays, you get that. And, I find it a little bit more flexible than standard PVC. It will give a little bit more, but it's not going to shatter when it gets frozen or with UVA. You know, you got UV hitting that pipe after 5-10 years, you're going to have a problem. They tend to crack.
Yeah, embrittlement. You get UV exposure when the polymerizing material inside starts evaporating. Okay. And the fact that it's a little bit more flexible is a mixed blessing when it comes to using it as a mask that you don't want whipping in the wind. But there's ways around that, as we already discussed. Go on with your next one if you want to, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. This one is a question about grounding. All right. This gentleman just made a nice copper plate, about 6 inches by 24 inches, quarter inch thick. It's transitioned through a window for all his antenna elements, wires. He punched the holes, he mounted in the chassis mount end connectors, 239s, a couple of BNCs as he has there. And he's going to take a number 6 wire from that solid copper down about 4 feet to a ground rod, which is 10 foot in the ground. His question is, should he bring a ground wire from the antenna mast down to the same ground rod? Do you advise that? Maybe you can help him out with that, Dick. Back to you, sir. KC2WGB.
If you want to be super conservative, I think the answer is yes. If your main antenna around the building with the most direct wiring you can get, 6-gauge wire, for instance, goes to a EIA standard ground rod, 8 or 10 feet long, I think it's a quarter inch diameter, galvanized or copper, rammed into the ground with the top of it below grade, the right kind of a connector on it. That's a so-called EIA standard, real good ground rod. If you bring grounding rod or wiring from your other antennas on the building to that, it, without a doubt, it is safer. And the smart guys do that. I haven't done it. In my case, I've got 100-foot of tower, and itself is very well grounded, and that's the local lightning arrestor for my piece of property and for my neighbors. The 12 guy wires that go to that tower and the earth screw anchors that they go into in the ground represents very good grounding. And I do have ground rods, one on the north side and one on the south side of the tower, connected to the tower with a 6-gauge piece of wire. So lots of grounding. That's the right way to do it. In the real world, unless you live in a particular place like where my grandfather's farm was in Port Washington, way back at the turn of the century, on the top of the hill on the north side of Port Washington, there's something about that particular piece of property that almost every electrical storm, lightning struck one of his barns and often created fires. And my grandmother, in turn, developed a huge fear of lightning because she had to live with it. Let me drop. And unfortunately, my grandfather never found out about proper lightning arresting grounding procedures, lightning rods on the top of his buildings. It would have saved him an awful lot of grief, and my grandmother saved her an awful lot of anxiety. So in the real world, except for somebody in a very unusual piece of real estate that has that problem, you would think that in my case, where I've got 100 feet of tower on top of 300 foot of land in Huntington, I'm the highest thing around, you would assume I'd be struck every day of the week. Well, in the, 1969, that makes it what? 70, here we go. 50 years or so, 40-some-odd years that I've lived here, lightning struck my tower on one occasion. Lightning struck in the vicinity on one occasion. And on that occasion, when it did strike in the vicinity, it didn't damage any of my radio equipment. It damaged my computing equipment because the lightning came in through the 110-volt line. Me and my neighbors all experienced a fair amount of lightning damage. It didn't come through the tower. It didn't come through the coax cables. It came through the 110-volt line. So if you had X-ray eyes and you looked down at your community, let me drop. And you look at all of that wiring up and down all of those streets, all of the Con Ed and LIPA power wiring. There's a tremendous amount of wire in your neighborhood, which is one hell of a large target. And 99.9% of the time, the lightning's going to strike that. You and I put up a dipole antenna hung in the trees, and it's a shiny piece of copper wire. And in our eye, it's the most mysterious, it's the most significant piece of metallic object in the neighborhood, and you assume lightning's going to strike it instantaneously. You get that assumption. Go ahead and do all the grounding. It's the right thing to do. A lot of people don't do it, and it's a rare situation where lightning gives you trouble. If lightning is going to give you a direct strike, protecting from that is quite difficult. The more conservative guys will have the right kind of connectors going through the wall for their cables to go outside the house, and they open up all of those coaxial cables when they know a lightning storm is coming. The conservative people will do that. And the next thing a guy will do is unplug all of his equipment from the 110-volt line, because it is much more likely the lightning strike is going to come through the 110-volt line than it is down your antenna. So the answer is it's the right thing to do. A lot of us don't do it. Very few of us suffer the damage because of that, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2MB with a question.
Yeah, Barry, go ahead. N2MB, you got it.
Yeah. Years ago, it was very popular with the lightning arrestors they put on top of the buildings. Now they just have little pointy sticks, maybe 3 or 4 or something across the top of the building. But a few years ago, they used to have these little balls that had a million little sharp points coming at them. Now, I don't seem to see that anymore. Do you think that they really work better or not? Over.
My gut feels the answer is yes, Barry. The one time that I was up my tower and high voltage, Mother Nature was coming along, I could tell because a snowstorm had just started in February, and the first experience I had is that the snowflakes were smacking me in the back of the neck. I said, gee, that's strange. I suddenly realized that there was a potential difference between those snowflakes and me, and the electrostatic attraction was making the snowflakes come and snap and slap me in the back of the neck is what I was experiencing. And I noticed that as I looked around me, the mast went a couple of feet above me with a 432 Yagi, and I noticed that the tips of the Yagi were all glowing purple, and I was hearing sizzling sounds. So when you got a whole lot of sharp, pointy objects, the lightning tends to, the local high voltage tends to be discharged by that. If you look at that beautiful YouTube video of this guy that climbs, he takes an elevator up to the 1,500-foot level, and he climbs the next 300 feet on this 1,800-foot tower somewhere in the Midwest. And he's got a camera on his helmet, and you see him climbing this tower, and he's eventually climbing past the vertical mast of this broadcast antenna. And you'll notice that at certain altitudes, they have this upside-down metallic broom object. The best way I can describe it, it was a metallic object with a whole bunch of sharp fingers coming out of it, metallic rods. And my experience is a whole lot of sharp points give you a high voltage concentration. The purple sizzle, I think, is capable of discharging the high voltage before the lightning bolt occurs. So it's my gut feel that that kind of an object will lower the number of times that lightning will strike in the first place. I think it's a good thing, and I'm a little disappointed, like you are, that they're no longer doing it. Into Moonbound, K2RIW.
Okay, thanks a lot. I thought that. Okay, back to net. Real good. N2MB.
I heard somebody with a call in, a CSK, with a comment. Very, very noisy. I'll give it a try. Go ahead with your comment. Amplifier. That in turn went to a meter, and there was a 9-volt battery there. As you tilted the yardstick, you thought over the yardstick parallel to the ground and the meter is zero. As you tilted the yardstick left side down, right side up, and vice versa, because of the electrostatic potential that always exists between Earth and the ionosphere, those polonium sources were ionizing the local air around the polonium source, and as such, it allowed your probe of your voltmeter, the operational amplifier in the middle really was a voltmeter, it allowed your voltmeter to make contact to that air. Air has a very high resistivity to it, but it is a volumetric resistor. You are living in a volumetric resistor called air, Barry, and so although it's got an extremely high impedance, if you've got a large enough metallic object, or if you grab onto enough of that air by ionizing it, I'm guessing that polonium source...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm guessing that that polonium source was ionizing the air for maybe 6 inches of radius all the way around that polonium source. It's the equivalent of having a 6-inch radius, a 12-inch diameter metallic ball. And if you could put a 12-inch diameter metallic ball on the right wing and the left wing of the airplane, you would get the exact same amount of stabilization, but the airplane wouldn't fly anymore. You have your cake and eat it too. You have the equivalent of a 12-inch diameter ball because you've ionized that much air by that polonium source, and yet the air is sweeping by the airplane and you're flying the airplane. Now, by having this radioactive source inside this ball, inside this lightning arrestor, you are again ionizing your local air, and I guarantee some sizzling takes place when lightning wants to strike that, very similar to having a whole lot of sharp, spiky objects. You're discharging the local e-field that has been generated that wants to make a lightning strike, and you're discharging it before it happens. That's my guess as to what's happening. See if that makes some sense, Barry. N2MB, K2LAW and the Tech Man.
I don't want to belabor this and hold the net up, but you think maybe next week we could go into this a little deeper? My whole lifetime, I never would have thought of doing that. That is amazing. Back to you, N2MB.
Actually, thank you so much for your support radioactivity and Mars, which is, I believe, very much interesting material.
Okay, Westwood, and I haven't seen that yet. It turns out that, Barry, the ionosphere, for whatever reason, is always sitting, I think it's a third of a million volts more positive than the Earth. I think it's a third of a million volts. The air itself is a mildly conductive material, even on a dry day. So you get a very even gradient of voltage versus altitude. Every time you... If I hold my hand out horizontal, the fingers of my hand are being exposed to, let me pick a number, 10 volts. If I raise my hand another foot, my fingers are being exposed to 14 volts instead of 10 volts, if you know what I mean. My body is highly conductive compared to the air. The current flow is picoamperes, and I never feel it. You build a high enough impedance amplifier, like with this polonium source. You can put this polonium source on a small insulator at the end of your hand that's connected to a voltmeter, so to speak, and as you raise your hand up and down, you would see the voltage going up and down. That air, which is a mildly conductive volumetric substance between ground and the ionosphere, is a great big potentiometer. And as you move your hand up and down, as you move the wing tip up and down with the polonium source, you're wiping that wiper across that potentiometer, and if you've got a high enough impedance circuit and a big enough ionization of air around it, like the polonium source gives you, you sense that voltage. So that makes a little bit more sense, Barry, as to what's going on here. N2MB, K2LAW.
Okay, it's beginning to. This is really a fascinating subject. I can, in my head, I'm thinking you could make an altimeter out of this, a tilt indicator, all kinds of things.
Well, there's a yes and a no to that. In the case of the two polonium sources, one on each wing tip of the airplane, or one on each tip of the yardstick, as you tilt the yardstick, the relative voltage is the equivalent of having two wipers on a potentiometer, and you're measuring the potential difference between the two wipers. That's like a charm. That'll work like a charm. To make an altimeter out of it, if you're trailing a wire to the ground, and you measure the difference between the wire on the ground and the polonium source that's on your airplane, yes, you've got an altimeter. But now if you just got one single terminal, a single polonium source on your airplane going into a voltmeter, where in the world are you going to put the lead of the voltmeter? Because your voltmeter wants to measure potential difference. And the potential difference is only from two different differences of altitude. And you and I want to know the altitude above ground, therefore you have to have a terminal that goes to ground. You see the problem, Larry? NQMB, K2LIW.
You know what I'm going to be thinking about it all night. There's got to be a way. Back to you, NQ, my problem.
Yeah, this real genius of a physicist named Maynard Hill at Applied Physics Laboratory, who first put this article in Flying Models magazine, roughly 1970. And Mario, being a model airplane enthusiast from way back, saw that, he started building it, and he has done a whole lot of experiments with flying radio-controlled model airplanes with automatic stabilization. By having a source on the right and left wingtip, he can tell if the airplane is rolled. By having a source on the nose and the tail, he can tell if the airplane is pitched up or pitched down. And he's done a bunch of experiments where he's flying an airplane in rough, windy weather, and he turns on that automatic stabilization network, and the airplane flies straight and level with one catch. On a rainy day, funny things happen. If you fly near a tree, the tree is a local grounding device poking into this volumetric material called air, and therefore you get a whole bunch of slanted lines of equal polarization around the tree. You fly your airplane where you think it's going to fly along the side of the tree, and it's going to tilt at a 45 degree angle as it flies by that tree, because the tree is disturbing the local E field of that volumetric potentiometer. By the way, a beautiful volumetric potentiometer is the water. And now you can slowly start picturing what those constant lines of voltage look like in seawater. If your body is in that seawater and there's a turned on electrical socket also in that seawater, you don't want to be there. This is a whole other interesting area, as you can tell. I know you've got at least one more you want to go to, John. KC2 WGB. That one's a beauty. K2RIW in the deck man.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Got one more. This one's a fairly simple one. A gentleman has an oscilloscope purchased, and it works fine. He has one problem with it, which he'd like your help. Where did he start? He has a couple of voltmeters and some milliammeters, and he has general knowledge. The problem with the oscilloscope is, although it works fine, the pattern is offset to the right. The centering control won't give him enough of a variance to bring it into the center. Maybe you could help him out on where to start to look. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
One of the very famous oscilloscopes made by Heathkit, the O11, I think it was called. I owned a number of them over the years and used them at various factories back in the dark ages. 6BY7 or something like that, with the push-pull tetrode tube that was the push-pull output amplifier for the horizontal reflection of that oscilloscope. As that tube got gassy, as the half-watt or one-watt carbon composition resistors, RCO7 resistors, in the cathode of that tube circuit, as those resistors aged, the circuit would become unbalanced, and the circuit and the display would shift over to one side. So, if it's a tube-type oscilloscope, gassiness of the tube is an aggravating factor. A change in the resistance of the two resistors. There's a resistor from each cathode to ground if it's a tube-type deflection circuit. And each of those resistors is dissipating a fair amount of power. And the nasty thing about carbon composition resistors, let me drop. Your particular brand of carbon composition resistors may be rated up to, let me pick a number, 75 degrees centigrade. And your particular circuit, for whatever reason, is running them at 70 degrees centigrade. You're inside of the right temperature specification. That's the good news. The bad news is carbon composition resistors, particularly the high year values, are continuously changing. You pick up a half megohm resistor that's really wired into a circuit, and you measure it today, on the day it was manufactured, it may be a half megohm, and today it may measure 150 kilohms. Things like that amount of drift of certain kinds of carbon resistors, carbon composition resistors, does take place. So by way of his volt-ohm milliammeter, he can go in there and measure each one of those resistors. Also, leaky capacitors. Some of the oscilloscope also had coupling capacitors going to the horizontal plate, which were wax paper type capacitors. And some of those developed a leakage in time. So a leaky capacitor, a changing value of the resistor, a gassy tube, any of these things can shift your oscilloscope off to one side. It's a very correctable problem. I didn't say it's easy, but with the right amount of research, it's correctable, in my opinion. Anyone else who has had experience with an oscilloscope that will not properly center itself horizontally or vertically, what did you find? What did you do to solve it? Did you want to give us some words on that? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet. And maybe we have nobody with that comment, but I've experienced that a few times. As I said, it's very correctable. It's not caused by the cathode ray tube itself. It's the voltage put on those two plates. And he can confirm the problem by, with his voltmeter in the high voltage scale, measure the voltage on the right plate and the left-hand plate of the horizontal deflection circuit of the cathode ray tube itself, and slowly by troubleshooting, work your way back as to what's unbalancing that amplifier that feeds those plates. Coupling capacitors, resistors, tube leakage, these are the usual causes. In fact, I also remember the Heathkit oscilloscope display that was a pan adapter. Heathkit made a pan adapter that you would connect to the IF strip of your receiver. And it had a circuit like that that would always drift. And it was a pain in the butt because of the component values that were underrated that created the problem in the first place. Each of these oscilloscope-like devices gave great performance for the first 6 months or year and a half. After that, they started drifting more and more because of these leakage problems. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, excellent recommendations, Dick. He already changed the tube, and it didn't do it, so that's where he stopped. But you're right. Basically, he has two identical amplifiers with different voltages, and if he compares them line for line and resistor for resistor, he should come up with it. That's a good trace. I think he'll do well with that. And he sent me a little picture of it, and it's a nice little 5-inch scope. So, well, good luck with that. Okay, I think it's about time we go over to Paul with the space report from KC2WGB from the mailbag.
Very good, John. Keep those cards and letters coming, and those emails and snail mails. Paul, what has NASA been doing this week? And as you know, as we dig into more and more of that report out of the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, which about 2 years ago was installed on the International Space Station, it's seeing a significant number of positrons, which is a kind of negative matter. What is it now? Negative matter?
Matter.
What was that again?
Antimatter.
The right word. It's seeing a significant amount of antimatter of the high energy particles. And so, I've got a guess on this one. And it'd be interesting if my guess turned out to be right. First of all, guess number one that I've had for a couple of years is that the so-called dark energy, where the outer portions of our universe, observable universe, are accelerating away from us faster and faster. And I'm guessing that there isn't one universe. We can only see one because we can only see a certain distance. But there are multiverses. There are multiple universes out there. And some of those universes over the hill, so to speak, beyond our vision, have got massive amounts of gravity, and the material at the perimeter of our universe is being sucked into those other universes. That's why it's accelerating. Okay, let me drop. Another one of my guesses is that they're real confused about the fact that at the instant of Big Bang, they knew there had to be as much matter as antimatter. All of the theory says it's got to be. And the big question is, where the heck is all of the antimatter? We only see matter. Well, in these multiverses, I think what really happened is that there wasn't one simple Big Bang that we're in the middle of. I think there was, just like your cosmic microwave background detectors and your Wolfensohn microwave anti-saturation probe, all of these probes are looking for the slight inhomogeneity of the universe. In other words, certain areas of the universe are a little bit warmer than other areas. Everything was a completely smooth explosion, if you know what I mean. There were hot spots. Well, by the same token, there's one super hot spot, meaning that our portion of the bang became the positive universe, and the anti-universe, the anti-particles, were the adjacent universe. So when you get supernovas in the adjacent universe issuing these super high energy particles, and now these negative polarity particles come flying toward us, and the alpha magnetic spectrometer sees them. I am guessing we're seeing the cosmic rays coming from the opposite polarity universe that's adjacent to us. That's my guess. It's going to take a long time to confirm that, if that's what it is. And you and I know that Mother Nature, no matter what you think is a nice simple model, what she's about to reveal to you is a hell of a lot more complicated. Over to you, Paul. So, what have you seen this week that NASA is doing? And WSQN, I'm a space expert, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, this is WSQN. That's a pretty fringe idea. Flying green would like to hear, see that theory, I think. This is the latest book to hit in reality. Really involved with multiverse. Pretty good book. Very hard to get through. I think it's supposed to be, you know, for the average person. Well, it's not. It's a complex, very complicated book. The whole topic is way out there. But that's a good theory. I just want to bring up the main, not that much, but the main thing I wanted to talk about is the Antares launch from Wallops Island in Virginia on Wednesday. So if you're retired or you're off, or if you get home early, 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, you can watch on a computer. I don't know if they'll have it on TV. It's not a manned launch. It's not even a launch to the International Space Station. But it is the first test of their launch vehicle, the Antares. When I say they, I mean Orbital Sciences built this thing. And they're also building the spacecraft that's going to go with it, the Cygnus spacecraft. That's not going to be on board. Let me drop it. I have a dummy payload, something that, you know, the same size and the same mass as the Cygnus spacecraft. That's not finished yet. But they wanted to test the vehicle, launch vehicle. It is going to go into orbit, and see how it does. I like it because it's very close to us. It's down in Virginia, a couple of states down. And we'll be making our... a track probably, you know, we won't see it. I think they're going to go out to the northeast. But it is that time, you know, 5 o'clock. I think if it was the winter time, you might have a shot. But being springtime, going into the summer, probably not at 5 o'clock. So that's really what they're going to do. They've already got a contract with NASA for 8 supply pipes to the International Space Station. I think it's something similar to what SpaceX is doing with the Dragon and the Falcon. SpaceX builds both. Orbital Sciences is building both the Antares and the Cygnus spacecraft. Drop it. And this year, they'll make their first launch of both spacecraft and launch vehicles. And that will go to the International Space Station for really a test supply flight that will bring up a certain amount of material, similar to what SpaceX did. I think they only brought 700-800 pounds up the first time, and then eventually they'll load up and double that in subsequent flights. So that should be interesting. It will be on a NASA TV.